Developmental Alternatives with Women for a New Era, OIDON, is a network of feminist scholars, researchers and activists from the economic south working for economic and gender justice and sustainable and democratic development. This recording is done by Dawn as a way of sharing its feminist critical analysis of the global environment through the voices of women from the south. Other recordings are available for download at www.dawnnet.org and may be used freely following proper citation. Dawn Podcasts, the voices of women creating a just world.
Now from Latin America to the last region to Asia, and the experience from Sri Lanka, the title of the talk is Lesbian, Bisexual, Transgender Rights in Relation to Militarization and the Post-Conflict Context in Sri Lanka.
Yes, as Anita said, the topic of my presentation will be lesbian and bisexual women's rights and transgender women's rights in relation to militarization and the post-conflict context in Sri Lanka. Before I start, just to give a brief background on the legal situation in relation to sexual rights in Sri Lanka. There are two key laws that I'll just refer to briefly. Maybe just to refer to where Sri Lanka is on the map for those of you who have never heard of it before or have no idea where it is. It's not in the Pacific Islands, and it's sort of just below India, that wee little island. It's also called a pearl of the Indian Ocean, teardrop-shaped island, all sorts of mad things. Anyway, so it's in South Asia, and that's where we're located. So just to go on with the background in terms of the legal situation for lesbians, bisexual women and transgender people in Sri Lanka. We've got the penal code which criminalizes homosexuality under the penal code section 365A of the penal code, which is actually the old archaic British sodomy laws that we have got because we were colonized by the British in the 18th century. So we still have this law, and as a result people of different sexual orientations can be criminalized under this law. Then secondly, there is also the Vagrants Ordinance of 1842, which is also once again another archaic British law that we've got, which allows the government or the police to basically arrest anyone who's deemed to be loitering in public. So this would actually mean that anyone who does not fit the usual gender stereotypes can get harassed by the police. Sex workers get harassed often by the police under the Vagrants Ordinance, and trans men and women, because they do not conform to the male-female boxes that are there for us in society. So those are the two main legal provisions that that basically criminalize and that LGBT people face threats within those two legal provisions. Then to go on to giving a brief background on Sri Lanka. Here we've got a close-up of the map, and the north and the east sections are highlighted. I'll come to that in a minute. So just to tell you briefly, ethnicity-wise, there's a majority ethnic group called the Sinhalese, or the Sinhala ethnic group, which are approximately, they consist about 84% of the country, and they're mostly Buddhists, which is a religion that they follow, or the philosophy, if you want to call it. And the minority group would be Tamils, who consist about approximately 11% of the population, and they are usually mostly Hindus or Christians. And there are two other minority ethnic groups, being Muslims and Burghers. And Burghers, not the McDonald's Burghers, but the Eurasians. So they are the ones who sort of the Portuguese and the Dutch who came down and colonized Sri Lanka, and they intermarried with the locals. So they're known as the Burghers. And population is just over 20 million, so it's quite tiny. And for the past 30 years, in fact, which is practically all my lifetime, most of my life, almost all my life, we've had an armed conflict in the country, and we've just come out of this ethnic conflict, which was in 2009. So the conflict was actually between the government of Sri Lanka, which is primarily a Sinhala Buddhist government, and the LTTE, which was the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, who were fighting for a separate state in the north and east of the country. So the LTTE mainly comprised of Tamils, But it did not mean that all Tamils were not part of the LTT movement. Some of them were because they took a very militaristic approach. So in May 2009, the government military defeated the LTTE after a very brutal attack where about 40,000 Tamils were killed and more than 60,000 were injured. And the entire conflict itself, I think, claimed about 70,000, over 70,000 lives over a period of 30 years. So it was quite a very bloody sort of brutal war that we've had for 30 years. And the north and east, that's the section that's marked in yellow. That's the area which basically where the conflict was sort of took place. That was the territory that the LTT wanted to claim as their homeland. So that's the background, and within that context, I'd like to talk about looking at LGBT rights within this kind of context. And I've got four key issues. I've got four key issues that I'd like to point out too, which would look at the armed conflict in relation to gender, economic, and environmental justice and LGBT rights. So the four key issues would be, one would be looking at the hierarchy of rights. Secondly, looking at a post-conflict nature of the victorious state and its implications. Thirdly, looking at entrenched militarization. And fourthly, looking at economic and ecological justice for women. And I will also end by looking at the mobilization strategies adopted by LGBT activists in Sri Lanka who have to work within such a climate. So first, looking at the hierarchy of rights. By this I mean that usually within a context that sort of, within such an armed conflict, what happens is usually that it sort of overshadows everything else in terms of looking at human rights and other rights. So you have human rights on the one hand, which, yes, is a bigger picture, of course. But in a sense, because of the conflict, that has actually overshadowed sexual rights. And so in a sense, you get the hierarchy, therefore, between economic and political rights on the one hand, over socio-cultural rights on the other hand. So that's the challenge that as LGBT activists that we face, because if we want to raise issues of sexual orientation, it's always seen as something flippant and not really important, you know. So because, oh my God, the war is bigger than that. But needless to say, sexuality has been brought up also within the context of the armed conflict, but within also a framework which can be heterosexual, or you could say within a heteronormative framework. So, for example, if sexuality is raised or has been raised, and it has been, it would usually be within a lens which looks at violence against women, so looking at rapes and harassment within situations of armed conflict, or looking at reproductive rights for women, and again looking at contraception for married women and not for, you know, for adolescents or youth, or single women, or for lesbians, or for transgender women, or for bisexual women. So basically, if sexuality has been dealt with, it has also been dealt with within that heteronormative framework, which again means that LGBT women are invisibilized within that context. So this brings me on to the next point, which looks at the post-conflict nature of the victorious state and its implications. So there are two points under that. The first point would look at nationalism linked to a control of female sexuality. So just to say that once the war was won by the government in 2009, it was sort of, there was this whole victorious kind of attitude that the government took on, you know, oh yes, we won the war, and it was almost sort of propagating a very singular Buddhist chauvinistic nationalistic agenda, which meant that, you know, there were lots of Tamils, I mean, there are still probably are many Tamils who obviously have a problem with that, because it's a Sinhala Buddhist government that's sort of victorious and, you know, majority, being the majority. So within that kind of context, there's also nationalism, and again, a particular type of nationalism that's propagated, and the kind of propaganda that's used by the government, which also, in a sense, controls women's sexuality. Two examples very briefly. In July 2010, nearly 300 heterosexual couples were arrested by the police for holding hands on the grounds of public indecency. So even, I mean, leave alone sexuality for like non-heterosexual women, even heterosexual people were arrested just on the grounds of it's not Sri Lankan, it's not, you know, it's not proper Sri Lankan behavior, because that's all Western. You shouldn't be holding hands in public, you shouldn't be snogging, don't even think about it. And another example is that in March 2010, a vice chancellor at a major university in Sri Lanka, suburbs of Colombo, demanded that two young girls go for a virginity test at a hospital. Why? Because they had been with their boyfriends in the university, on the university grounds, and they should not be with boyfriends because, you know, they can get pregnant, and basically that whole thing about that. So they were sent for virginity tests, and that was also a huge uproar. But just this whole, you know, policing of sexuality in general, yeah. So that's one point. So secondly, under that same thing, also looking at nationalism linked to the valorization of masculinity. Again, post-conflict, after the government won the war, there were lots of these ads that came up in the television, on TV, basically, which looked at the armed forces and how great our war heroes have been, and the army is so fantastic, and oh, if you're a young woman looking for a partner, you need to look for a navy officer or an army officer, because they are fantastic and they are our heroes and we need to worship them, etc., blah blah blah. So again, there's masculinity that's valorized, but it's also a very particular type of masculinity. So looking at masculinity, which is also reserved and also kind of, a gender performance, or it's something that's reserved for men only. So within that context, if I also just talk about briefly about how female masculinity, that's actually a concept that has been spoken about by Judith Halberstam, and I'm sure many others, where she actually talks about female masculinity being masculinity as being separate from men and maleness. So if you separate masculinity from men and maleness, then women can also perform masculinity without really being men. So, you know, there are different ways to perform masculinity. And you can de-link yourself from maleness, but you can still perform masculinity. So within that framework, looking at female masculinity and linking that to butch lesbians, I don't know if I'm butch lesbian, but I dress like this on a regular basis. And in Sri Lanka, it's seen as a problem. I can't walk on the streets. I get, you know, just people say things, I can't go by bus, you know, it can be a problem, because what am I, a girl or a guy? It's confusing, so that's a problem. And if you're a woman, you need to be a woman, you need to grow your hair long, you need to wear earrings, you need to wear makeup, you need to be in a dress, etc. So again, restrictions on gender identity and expressions of gender identity, again, and masculinity also being preserved for, you know, it's a sacred space, so women cannot enter that space either. And just to add to that also, that it's actually mainly women in the low economic strata who are the ones who are the most vulnerable, because again, I've got my own bike, so I travel by motorbike. I do not have to use public transport, but people who do have to use public transport face much more harassment. Those who practically, you know, walk around face violence by just police or by just public or the society in general, just because they look different, or just because they do not look stereotypically feminine. And the next point, the third point, is looking at entrenched militarization. Again, during the conflict, we had many, many, many checkpoints throughout Colombo and throughout the island, in fact. Checkpoints where you get armed officers, either the army or the police, sometimes the navy. They would say, if you're driving along or if you're walking on the streets, they'd stop you and ask you for your identity cards. And if you're Sinhalese, it's fine. You show your ID and walk by. No problem. Usually no problem. But if you're Tamil, it is a problem. Sometimes it can be a problem. They could sort of cross-question you even more. And if you're actually a transgender woman or a transgender man, so your ID card would say you're female because you're biologically female, but if you're a transgender man, you dress and you're passing as a man, that has also created problems and challenges for trans men, which, you know, that's one of the challenges they face. In the post-conflict scenario, there has also been an increased restrictions on mobility of Tamil women who are located within the displaced camps in the north and the east, now that the war is over, so they'll be rehabilitated. because of the now that the conflict is over, most of the men have either they're disabled, or they've left the town, or they've left their wives, so they're not there. So usually there are more women around in that area, and as a result, there's also due to the high presence of military officials and the army, there is a lot of sexual bartering that goes on. So there's a lot of violence and harassment also faced by women, and women particularly are even more vulnerable at this period of time. So if you can imagine that women are the ones who are sort of worst vulnerable, or the most vulnerable in this kind of situation, you can only imagine that LGBT women are completely out of that situation. I mean, are even worse, at a worse situation, because they're completely invisibilized. And again, post-conflict, there's also been many restrictions to freedom of association and organizing. There's been an increased scrutiny of NGOs, particularly by the government. So, and also scrutiny of funding, and where is the funding coming from, what are these NGOs, what are they working on. So the organization that I work, one of the organizations I work for, the LGBT rights one, we actually have to register ourselves as a company, because we cannot register under the NGO's secretariat, due to the scrutiny by the government. And so there are challenges there. But also we have to strategize as a result. So we actually, when we try to do awareness raising work, we use health, or we use HIV AIDS, or we use reproductive rights as an entry point to talk about sexual orientation. And I'd like to just also talk about the CEDAW, that's the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. And Sri Lanka was reviewed by the CEDAW committee in January this year. And for the first time, actually, LGBT groups got together and submitted a separate shadow report on LGBT rights, and it was picked up by the committee. So for the first time, actually, we are really thrilled that the CEDAW committee picked up sexual orientation in the concluding observations. So that means that we can actually use that now to move forward to try and get decriminalization, maybe, I don't know, 50 years down the line at least, when I'm old and gray. But, you know, that's a step forward, so hopefully that will happen. That was a great thing for us. So I guess by strategizing and using different ways, we're trying to move forward. We also we also work with the women's movement, because I think that's a very key important strategy, because there's no point being sort of working separately as LGBT activists. And we need the women's movement also for their support, and we need their support as well. I'll go on to the next point, the fourth point, which is looking at economic and ecological justice. So Sri Lanka is primarily an agricultural economy, and within the post-conflict scenario, lands were ravaged, and because so agriculture meaning rice is what's cultivated primarily, but due to the conflict, lots of people lost their lands. And then if they had animals or cattle or chicken or poultry, they lost all of that. They also, if the land was still there, it was very often arid because of continuous years of wars and just not using the land for so many years. So when people started now that people have started settling back in their home locations or their hometowns, also landmines, that's the other problem. There are still uncleared areas of landmines. So now when they sort of settle back there, employment has become a problem for many women, because access to employment is difficult because they don't have land, access to land, or just poultry or farming or vegetables, even growing vegetables is a challenge. So those are some of the issues they have to deal with. And the government of course has their compensation and assistance packages that they give out to returnees. But the problem there again is that usually it's given to there's something that you have to fill up which asks you for, you know, the head of the household. So again, in a Sri Lankan context, the head of the household is assumed to be a man. So usually, because the men are not there anymore, many of the households are now female-headed households, the women's movement has been continuously trying to tell the government that you need to accept that women are also heads of households, and they should also be given the provisions because they are the ones. just to rush off there, so what I was trying to say is that because the provisions and the government's compensation very often is within, again, a heteronormative framework. So the family unit, once again, is, you know, mother, father and children, but not women living on their own or not lesbian or bisexual women or transgender people. So again, LGBT people are left out of that framework. Just finally to raise a question about how do we link up with the women's movement? I know there are lots of challenges there because I'm someone who has one foot in the women's movement and one foot in the LGBT movement. So I believe that working together is very crucial. But I know that within the women's movement, there can be also very homophobic. Sometimes, you know, people can be homophobic. And within the LGBT movement, people can be, there are people who are quite antagonistic towards the women's movement because they feel that they do not pick up their issues enough and, you know, stuff like that. But the point is, the question is then how do we move forward? How do we actually, just as women's rights were once human or are human rights, how do we make sexual rights women's rights? Thank you.
For more information on the work of Dawn, do not hesitate to contact us. Our email address is info@dawnnet.org.